Over the course of 15 years of reflecting on my own testimony, I realized that I was sharing it in a way that didn't even resonate with myself.
Well, that was Josh Chen from Crew talking about how what words you use can change everything about how you share the gospel with your peers. Hey, everyone, this is Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show. Welcome to this week's episode. Later on for our inbox, we actually have a listener who's been dating a guy for over 2 years, and she thinks maybe it's time to get engaged. Does he agree? There are currently crickets. So what should she do about that? Fortunately, our own VP of marriage, Greg Smalley, is here to weigh in with some great advice. All right. Well, here we are for our roundtable. Very pleased to have Jake, Catherine, and Matt with us. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey.
All right. So most folks know who you are. Jake, married, social media. Catherine, producer.
I didn't marry social media. I just want to be clear about that.
Catherine, producer, awkward. Matt.
Do we all need to give our relationship status, too?
Well, she just self-describes as awkward.
So oh, okay.
That's why I had to,
how
say,
do I self-describe?
Had to say that. So you're not self-describing. I'm describing you.
Okay.
So, okay. And then we have Matt, Axis, fun and footloose and fancy free. So,
that was
all right.
So forced.
That's not true. I'm a terrible
awkward
dancer.
Anywho.
You're just an awkward producer.
Speaking of just giving people labels, maybe I could describe that as one of my hobbies, because that is what we're going to talk about this week, is hobbies. So Catherine does a very good job of putting feelers out to our peeps about things that they're thinking about, especially as we, you know, are in warmer months now, and we're kind of like, hey, what can I do with my summer? And what will, you know, just kind of perk up my life a little bit? And incidentally, I think you said, Catherine, that on online dating profiles, it's indicated that people that have hobbies and actually have interesting hobbies get more views and get more interest from people.
Yeah, I was super surprised that I came across this study from, it was like, I think it was by eHarmony. And they said people that list hobbies on their online profiles get more, like, interaction. More people talk to them because it makes you interesting.
So I think that depends on what hobbies.
Yeah.
Well, apparently.
Because some people just say, like, the same hobbies, and I think I just glaze over those. I think they're boring.
Okay. Well,
this is data,
that's,
Lisa.
That's fair.
Data.
I feel like I have a lot of those hobbies, though.
Well, give us a few of them.
Yeah. So they actually, apparently, from their study, this is not a stereotyping. This is their study. So men find women who like family, dancing, food, and exercise attractive. So women that had those listed on their profile were apparently more attractive. For women, they found it attractive when men listed traveling, exercise, food, learning, politics, and theater, interesting enough.
Theater.
Apparently that is like attractive for girls. Which I know that does not apply to all girls or all guys at all, but that's what the study found.
But
isn't that interesting?
Wait,
do you hear that? Do you hear that? That's the sound of 1,000 people changing their eHarmony profile right now.
I don't understand how family is a hobby, but whatever.
Okay. Well, like spending time, I guess, with their family.
Oh, okay. I mean, think about it. If you're a single girl and you see a single guy who likes to spend time with his family.
No, it was vice versa. The guys like girls.
Yeah,
who
guys
like
girls who like family.
Oh.
The girls like politics and theater.
We just entered some gender stereotypes here.
We did.
Time.
I know, yeah. But that's what the study said.
So if you're like working for Second City, the Second City Players in Chicago, you're like set. Political humor in the theater.
And your folks live in Chicago and you spend dinner.
You spend a lot of time
every
with
Wednesday
them.
Night.
You're all set. Get that eHarmony profile up and you'll be married in a minute.
But I think that applies to life, not just online dating, you know?
Yeah. My guy friends would always complain about when they were on online profiles and all the girls, like when it says the three things you can't live without, and they were inevitably like Diet Coke, flip-flops, and Jane Austen or something. And they're like, seriously? Anyway, just funny.
It should be Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, actually.
Oh, whoa. Let's get John Acuff in here. Steph Christian said.
Very true. Okay, so let's just talk about, would you guys consider yourselves to be hobby-esque people? Because I feel like I had to really concentrate to figure out what my hobbies are. So maybe I'm just in a slump. I don't know. What are your? Do you just throw out all these hobbies when people ask you?
Yeah, that's actually a good question, because we talked about it and I tried to like jot down my favorite hobbies, and all of them I was like, I'm not super committed to any of these. Like, I'm interested in rock climbing. I'm interested in skiing, and I do it every now and then.
Yeah.
Matt, we'll do another episode about your commitment issues.
Okay? Yeah, we should probably should.
Well, that's like, it's
we really actually
was that your girlfriend that's like, been dating for 2 years and is waiting for the ring on it?
No, like living in Colorado, you feel obligated to be into hiking.
That's true.
I enjoy hiking, mm-hmm. but I would say that if I wouldn't walk into an REI and like see myself in an ad.
Oh my God.
I don't
word.
Consider
I love
myself
REI,
this.
So maybe this is real
but,
for me.
Okay. But I mean, yeah. And people, you know, then there are more like hardcore ones like rock climbing or ice climbing or whatever, that things that require gear. I don't do that. I go and I like camp somewhere and go on hikes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's I mean, it. I think there's a couple of different levels of hobby. Like, and I think everybody thinks about it different. Some people are hardcore hobbyists where yeah. they find that one or
good
two
at
things.
Stuff. Like, they do things they're good at.
Yeah, and they're like semi professional at them, right. even though it's just a hobby.
Natasha's like right. that. She commented on this post about this roundtable and she listed her hobbies in categories. I was very impressed.
Wow. Super organized.
Yeah. And
maybe her hobby is organization.
Oh, good point.
I think it's a spiritual gift. It's listed as like the spiritual gift of administration.
Yeah.
But what's now, the other
so,
side?
But then there's that other side of like when this question was posed to me is what's my hobby? I don't really actively think about, hey, do I have a hobby? Is there something I do? I just tend to do things that I don't think about them in terminology of hobbies. I'm not pouring tons of money into them. I just tend to like the hobbies I gravitate towards tend to be more casual. Like I'll play pickup games of basketball or football or frisbee, and then I'll play video games. The closest one that I could say like I concentrate on is doing my podcast, where I'm putting in time, thinking of show ideas, planning it out, making sure I've done show prep and all that. But mm-hmm. in general, I just kind of fall into things. I'm not out there thinking, what's my next hobby? Mm-hmm.
Can we distinguish what a hobby is real quick? Because that podcast sounds like a bit of work.
So that's...
And I don't know if there's crossover.
Something Theron brought up, because he said he wants to find hobbies that don't have anything to do with what he does for work, which I guess your work isn't necessarily podcast, but I have that problem because I love reading and I read a lot at work. So if I go home and read more, I like do the same thing all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all of us listed reading as a hobby. So I'd be interested in knowing like what, when you say you're reading as a hobby or reading for fun, what are you reading?
So my reading has led to friendships, which seems very ironic to me. But last summer, one of my friends invited me, well, I didn't really know her very well, invited me to see this author talk that she knew I liked too. And because of that, we're like really good friends now because we went to that. And this past weekend, we went to a thrift store and we're each like piled books up to our like chins and like carrying them to the register because we're like, oh, we love this author. So, I mean, that I feel like the hobby is... You find an author that you like and follow them.
Oh.
And then
okay.
talk to people
that's your
about
definition
that author.
Of a, well, but that sounds more
well,
like an obsession.
Your, that's your preferred
like just hobby.
That's just straight stalking.
No.
we follow her everywhere. It's great.
So I see a distinction in this where like at Axis, a ton of people read all the time like for research, cultural research and theological research. But my reading, I don't do a ton of it for work. If I do, it's a business book because I'm in the marketing world. But what I read for fun outside work is always like sort of a self-improvement thing or fiction. Like I just finished Far From the Madding Crowd and it took me a couple months to read because it's like my bedtime book and I read a little bit before I go to bed to help me fall asleep. Works like a charm, everybody out there who's having trouble falling asleep.
Is that an endorsement of the book? Guys, it puts me to sleep so well.
Yeah, that's a strong endorsement. I think it's got great things to say in that book.
Yeah, but like, I would say for fun, I definitely read fiction. I like to read suspense, and I like especially from like the 40s, 50s, and 60s, like authors from that era. Big fan. So
that's cool.
It's very specific.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily U.S. Like a lot of
defining
European
a
stuff
hobby.
Too.
Like we look at outside of maybe what we're paid to do, or like what we're doing to volunteer, or is volunteering a hobby?
I think it is.
I think that's where you could say that might
be, yeah.
Like where does that line cross? Like is hobby things we do to find rest or is it just things we find to do outside of our careers?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought about this actually. I was thinking about this round table. I was sitting at my desk and I looked up on my corkboard and there is a card from my mom that I like put in my corkboard. And on the front of it, it says like it has like mountains and this girl sitting there and it says relax. My mom knows me what I need. but then it has like the definition and it says to engage in a restful activity. And that made me think of hobbies. So I don't know. Good question. I feel like it's both. But yeah. Sometimes relaxing can be doing a hobby.
Right. Some people are relaxed when they're, for example, like you could say that playing sports, which is something like I said, playing pickup sports I love to do, it's not necessarily restful. It requires a lot of physical exertion. And yet for me, it's a rest for my mind mm-hmm. because when I'm playing sports, and I've been this way ever since I was a kid, when I'm playing sports, I'm in the moment. Mm-hmm. I'm not worrying. I'm not anxious. I'm not planning. I'm not thinking. I'm not you know, pondering. I'm just caring about what's happening in the moment. And so it's very restful for my mind, even if it isn't for my body.
Yeah. I'm kind of, I got into tennis probably a little over a year ago. I feel like I need to take some lessons though, because I'm kind of overachiever. Like, I know that people are really good at tennis. So then I'm like, how can I get actually like good instead of just jumping around the court? Of course, then I had foot surgeries and now I'm sidelined, but that's where I feel like it's something like I want to be a good tennis player and I'm just not, you know. I feel like I have latent abilities that need to be brought out. No,
you're waiting to be tennis activated.
Whereas hiking, I'm kind of like, you know, oh yeah, I like to hike and I go hiking, but I'm not like, I will do every 14er in Colorado. I don't have like goals related to hiking. That's more just like grab a friend and go do it. Okay, what's everyone's kind of oddest hobby? Because we said that we kind of all put reading. I think a lot of people put travel, which is like, yeah, love it, but you know, you have to have funds and or the ability, you know, to go and do that stuff. What's something that's kind of odd that y'all do?
The one that's odd that I've only recently picked up and am getting into for me is I'm writing a stand-up comedy routine.
Ah.
Yes. So
if there's anybody I wanted to see that from, I think you're in the top five.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Great. John Chris will be your friend.
Yeah, John, if you're listening.
Shoot him another Twitter message.
I'd love to.
John Chris is going to approach you and be all awkward and then tweet you. And
hey, I don't know if you know this, but we went to the same church.
If you're listening and wondering what we're talking about, the episode's called Friend Finder. Hear Jake's weird
story. Hear my weird story with John Chris. It's totally super awkward. But it's scary, you know, thinking about telling jokes. Like it feels a lot easier when you're in a group and you're kind of riffing off of each other and you know each other and you're just saying goofy things and people laugh because they like you, mm-hmm. versus having to like go in front of a crowd of people. But I'm kind of excited by that at the same time, that mm-hmm. challenge of people who have no idea who I am being like, entertain us, funny boy. And so, but it's scary to think that you could build all this material and write it all out. Like it takes a lot of work to build an act, and I actually lost it. I had a file and it got deleted.
Wow.
I had to rebuild it. So
it's bad.
But you know, I'll invite you guys when it's time to do my opening act.
Yeah,
we're honored.
Should people follow you on Twitter so they know when it's happening?
Oh, certainly, yeah. You know, if you guys want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at @Jake_Roberson. There you go.
Well, that's
I do try jokes there, actually.
That's super brave. Our listener Alana said she like is fear of the unknown keeps her from trying new hobbies. And I totally relate to that. When I played violin since I was 4. So when I got to middle school, I was like, this is not cool. I want to play electric guitar. So I was like, Mom, can I quit violin? And she was like, Catherine, I really think you should stick it out. One day, I was at this talent show, and I played violin a violin song. And my friends who were my age were like, wow, Catherine, you play violin? That's so cool. Including this guy that I thought was really cute. And I was like, I never want to quit violin. Which I'm ashamed to say that that's the reason.
And your mom hands each of them $10.
I'm ashamed to say that that's the reason violin is still a hobby of mine. But I'm so glad I didn't drop it. So it's kind of odd. Not a lot of people my age, I think, play. But it's brought a lot of friendships and stuff.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's good. What's an odd one for you?
I don't think I can classify these as hobbies, but I recently, for the first time, went rock climbing and swing dancing. And they were
at the same time?
Same time. It was this crazy little hole-in-the-wall place in old Colorado City. No. And the reason that they were big for me was because I wanted to do both, but both made me intensely uncomfortable.
And for you, the listener, I was there that night, and Matt danced with his girlfriend and you guys looked good.
Oh my
I was
gosh.
Impressed.
It was
you were stalking
it
Matt
was good.
And your
Next
favorite
time
author?
Take
no,
photos,
it's a
Catherine.
Friend group. Yeah, I should have.
Post them on the insiders page.
Yeah, we'll put them on our...
It's a friend group of stalkers.
You did well.
Leave us alone.
I'm proud of you. I didn't even realize you were that nervous.
Well, so, yeah.
He looks so smooth.
Perhaps a better example is the one where Catherine wasn't there with the rock climbing.
Nice.
But like rock climbing was something I'd really wanted to do, especially since I moved to Colorado. And it actually took a friend of mine from Michigan coming to town and saying, hey, I'm really into rock climbing these days. Can we go here somewhere? I was like, yeah, I know all the gyms. I've just never been to any of them because I'm too intimidated. So we went and I was like, this is awesome. But also, like, I am so uncomfortable just physically clinging to the side of this thing. And like culturally, I don't know any of these people. I feel like I don't belong in this big misshapen room. And this is all really, really odd to me. So I should come back and I should do it again because it's really uncomfortable. Like I've I almost wonder if it's kind of like your stand-up thing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a sense where I, even though I'm afraid of it, I like that feeling of being pushed outside of my comfort zone because
yeah.
I know there's growth to be had there. Whether it's in stand-up comedy or whether I flunk out and it's just growth in my own personality and experience.
Can I ask a question? I guess I just wonder, should we be comfortable in our own hobbies or should we try things? Where's the balance there? What do you think?
I don't necessarily. I mean, I tend to think of or stereotype hobbies as, oh, you have to have a certain skill, like you knit or you're a woodworker or you are super awesome, like in some sport or whatever. But I would say, I mean, again, I had to sit and rack my brain about, like, what are my hobbies? And mine are, I mean, speaking of odd, I put, like, one, I think of, like, the ways I use my time. So, one, I love to declutter. I feel like I'm an aspiring minimalist. And so that's kind of become a hobby for me. Like, I'm making goals to get rid of stuff, like, in my house. And so I do that. I also love acquiring trivial knowledge. I am probably the only person I know that is in a conversation with someone and ends up Googling, like, six things out of that conversation that lead me on trails about other things. So the other night I watched a movie with Doris Day in it. I Googled Doris Day. That led me to learning about her son and then about Cary Grant and then about people he was associated with. And it was like an hour-long process of just reading random things about people.
Just real quick, what was the Doris Day movie?
That Touch of Mink.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't highly recommend it, folks. It was a little bit weird. But I like other Doris Day ones, just saying. And then I feel like I'm also an olive connoisseur. I'm going to be honest about it. I love olives, and I may or may not have ordered olives online.
Excuse me, you tease me
before.
For liking chicken crackers, and you've ordered olives online?
Olives are a whole food. They're not like some processed, boxed product.
Did you order them straight from Italy?
Ooh, is there like
a snobby
level to hobbies,
too? From a couple different spots. You know, there are different types of olives. Yeah. There are different flavors of olives.
That's an interesting one, because there's like actually a whole mafia behind the olive oil business, so I wonder if they're also getting their fingers in the olive business.
Can you confirm this mafia?
Have you tracked that, Lisa? Like piece of knowledge?
I haven't. I haven't right. really dug Go deep look up into the olive, oil olive cartel. Underbelly.
it's kind of crazy. Like,
okay, well,
most of the olive oil we get here in the States is watered down, guys. It's a real thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay,
that's the kind of quirky hobby I wanted right there.
Yeah. Well, so what do you guys think about the, like, should it be stretching or should it be just something that you're comfortable with and or enjoy?
I think it should be stretching. I heard a quote once that was like, if you're not uncomfortable sometimes, you're probably not growing very much. And so I feel like so going swing dancing the other night was hard for me too. And there was one of Matt's friends
in
our friend group, and he asked me to dance, and he was like a super good dancer, and I was like stumbling everywhere, and like he was turning me, and I was like, and it was very, I was awkward.
Lisa. This is Catherine, awkward
I was
producer.
Awkward.
I will say, if anybody's thinking of doing this, I felt very comfortable there. They had like these teachers and leaders who were my age, and it was just super chill.
Nobody was judging me, which was nice.
but it was at the end of the night, I was kind of proud of myself because I was like, hey, I just did something I'm not good at, and it makes me remember that I don't have to be perfect, you know? Yeah. So I think it should be stretching.
I think it ought to be both and, really. Like, we have those things, like for me, where at times, I just want to go play flag football or basketball or ultimate frisbee, something I feel very comfortable with that I know how to do, that I can do without thinking about it. Those can be very cathartic, like kind of soul cleansing experiences, mind cleansing experiences. But at the same time, if that's the only thing you ever do, yeah, you might miss opportunities to grow. But if the only thing you ever do is look for opportunities to grow, are you ever giving your mind the rest that it needs, or your body the rest that it needs? So I think a good balance of both is healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, I can think of like just going on little day hikes, reading a fiction book, or going on a bike ride are like super easy for me. It kind of turns off a certain section of my brain, each one, and it activates another, each one of them. But also, like, the flip side, skiing and rock climbing and building websites, like, those are all kind of fringe hobbies too, and each of them are a little more stressful and unconventional and uncomfortable for me, and they kind of like push me in a different direction.
Okay, so how would you encourage, I mean, just in the minute that we have left, people to go about finding new hobbies, or how to, you know, for the people that are like, hey, I want to try something new, or I want to do.
I liked what our listener Lindsay suggested. It's borrowing stuff from your friends. So like, she like wanted to go backpacking, so she borrowed a bunch of gear and tried it before committing to buying all that stuff and then not liking it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, don't worry about having to spend a ton of money. Like, if you know, find those that are already doing it. They're usually looking for other people who are interested, and they'll welcome you in. So look for those communities that are already
or
doing
meetups. Those are
yeah,
good.
Meetups. Mm-hmm. I think that was mentioned by Elizabeth. And sorry, totally forgot her name. I wanted to call her like Theron or something. but Elizabeth mentioned doing meetups. Like, find the people that are already doing it. They'll welcome you in. They'll lend you gear, and then you can find out if you really like it.
Yeah. I think we also should make the distinction, because Catherine pulled this out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that most Americans spend more time doing passive leisure, hello Netflix, than actually doing things that are active.
And not, apparently,
it doesn't have to be active like sports active, but just things that are, you know, engaging your mind instead of passively consuming your time and your mind.
Right. Like, I don't think you get the benefits of hobbies if you do passive things, or that's what the study said.
Right. Letting life happen to you. Don't let it happen, people. Come on. Good thoughts, you guys. Thanks.
Thanks.
Have you heard the good news? Have you heard the good news? We can live in hope because of what the Lord has done. A hope for justice and a hope for peace. A hope for those in desperation.
Well, folks, for today's culture segment, we get to introduce you to Josh Chen. Josh is actually a guy who's been with Crew for years. I'm not going to say years and years and years. That just makes him sound old. He's not old. But has served with Crew, knows young adults. And we're going to actually have a conversation today on sharing the gospel, but it's not what you think it is. This is about what does it look like, insights that he has gleaned from living, eating, breathing with millennials for a long time. So, Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be on here.
So you actually said, I was reading a little bit of your testimony, you actually grew up in church, officially being the president of your youth group. So that's pretty hardcore. After high school, walked away from your faith because you didn't see how it applied to your life. Now, that could be the storyline for any number of millennials out there, whether they are still in school, whether they are young professionals, whatever. In fact, I think your sister even was a missionary in China, and you just basically said, I don't want to be a Christian anymore. What did she say to that?
Well, she actually said something pretty surprising. She pulled out the old Revelation passages of, if you're lukewarm, then I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. And that's exactly what I told her I was lukewarm. And so she goes, and I'm like, I can't be hot. And she goes, well, go cold, which was just, I look back and really bizarre thing, but really a God thing that she said, because I walked away and, in the midst of that, just had to wrestle with a lot of issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I want you to kind of talk a little bit about this idea of, yeah, I grew up in church, but I don't really believe it. Why is that so typical for a young adult generation? Why? I mean, it seemed like, a couple generations ago, like our parents and grandparents, it was much more, of course I believe it because this is what I was always taught. Why would I ever let go of that? Now it seems to be a complete shift. Where are we at?
Well, I think as I've been looking into millennials, I just realized that millennials are asking different questions than their parents were. A lot of what their parents were asking, it kind of came out of this worldview where, of course, God exists. Well, now we don't live in that same worldview in many places of the country. And so the questions they were asking were questions like, how do I get to heaven and what do I do with my guilt? Whereas with millennials, they're just asking different questions. They're asking questions more along the lines of, what does it mean to thrive as a human being? And so really, when we think about the gospel, we have to think of how does the gospel answers the longings and questions of every human heart. And really, when we think about the gospel, we have to think about how it does that. And when we communicate it to someone, what are the questions that they're asking? And a lot of how we present the gospel nowadays, honestly, answers a question of a different generation.
Yeah. Give us a couple examples of those types of questions. Like, what are considered valuable to millennials? What about the way they're living life makes certain questions right and others wrong?
You know, it's interesting because we traditionally in missionary circles talk about how there is a guilt and innocence culture. There's a shame and honor culture, and how there's a fear and power culture. And traditionally, we talk about Westerners as having more of a guilt and innocence culture, whereas Eastern and Middle Eastern and different parts of the world have more of a shame and honor culture. And so when we talk about the shame and honor culture, you could probably tell by my last name that I'm Asian American. And I worked in Asian American ministry for 10 years, and we always talked about the gospel in light of shame and honor. And so when my wife spoke in front of a large group of people that were predominantly Westerner or, majority culture, she talked about it still in light of shame and honor. And people were coming, her staff and students were coming up to her and saying, "You're putting language to things that I've felt all my life, but I haven't felt the gospel break into." And for me, that was an eye-opening moment. Like, okay, are we in the midst of a cultural shift? I think what's happening is that we're moving from a guilt and innocence culture to a shame and honor culture. And it doesn't look exactly the same as Eastern culture. In fact, there's some key differences because of the individualism of American culture. Versus more of the collective nature of Eastern and Middle Eastern cultures. And so, I just think that as we're making that shift, the gospel answers the questions of a shame and honor culture maybe a little bit differently than a guilt and innocence culture. And so I did this kind of test. The next time I spoke in front of a group, I just kind of threw this out there. I go, "What sounds like the best news to you? Like, what sounds like the good news to you? A, Jesus Christ died for my sins, freeing me from hell and allowing me to go to heaven. B, Jesus Christ died to free me from my shame, to allow me to be who I was created to be. Or C, Jesus Christ defeated the principalities of the world, freeing it from its demonic oppression." And as you could probably tell, A is the guilt and innocence framework, B is the shame and honor framework, and C is the power and fear framework. 11 people said A, 21 said B, and 6 said C. And so the next time I did that in a smaller group, every single one of them said B, but all of them felt like they ought to have said A, because that is what we're traditionally told is the gospel.
So what would you say, like, knowing that you're talking to millennials, most of whom are sitting, you know, being taught by pastors who are probably boomers or, you know, maybe even older. So they're being told, okay, here, to share the gospel, go out and say, you know, if you were to die tonight, what would you have to do or say to get into heaven, you know, and that kind of stuff. You know, all the old school ways of doing that. And they're kind of like, yeah, what do I do with that? I don't know what. Give an example of what it would look like for just a friend to be having a conversation with a friend, a believer who's having a conversation with a friend who doesn't know Christ, and just, you know, what that could look like as far as how they treat them, like their actions, what they share from their own heart, how they can incorporate hope and scripture into that. Give us a picture of what that could look like, because I think we're so often in old constructs, even though young adults feel like, yeah, that for some reason this feels super awkward to me, but I don't know how to do it differently.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's something that I've had to wrestle with for the last 15 years. In fact, as I shared my own testimony over the course of 15 years of reflecting on my own testimony, I realized that I was sharing it in a way that didn't even resonate with myself. because I kind of fit it into the framework that I was told this is what works, and that was your conversion testimony. And my testimony is one of those testimonies that, like, a lot of people are like, oh, man, I wish I had a testimony like that. And it is kind of this radical experience. And yet it didn't even resonate with me because I was trying to explain it in a way that showed that this is proof that God exists. And in fact, what really resonated me was this idea that God was pursuing me and that he was affirming my inherent values. And because I already knew that God existed, honestly, I just was kind of fearful that he didn't want me. And so I like to tell millennials that we need to focus more on micro testimonies than our conversion testimony. And our conversion testimony is great, but it's more like, how does God affect my everyday life? And for people that are like, I don't like my testimony. Well, this is good news for them because now you can focus on how God's impacting your life right now and not necessarily how he initially brought you to faith.
Right. Which is great news for people like me who have the lamest conversion testimony ever. So, you know, yeah. I'm the one that was like, I think I accepted Christ at 5 and it just always seemed like he was there, you know, kind of that thing. So that's good. You know, you can kind of juxtapose the two of ours and be like, oh, man, Josh's is so awesome and mine's super lame. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know tons of people like that. But lately I've been focusing much more on my micro testimonies, which is like, how's God impacting my life right now, today? Mm-hmm. And so what I tell people is to listen to what people complain about, because in there, they're looking for something. They're longing for something. They're finding life where there is no life. And when we can identify that, we can, if we've experienced something similar, we can share our story. And so an example of that is, remember this gal was like, man, I'm so stressed out at work. And I told her, oh man, I feel for you because 6 months ago I felt the same way. And she was like, 6 months ago? Did something happen 6 months ago? I go, yeah. And then she was like, did your job get easier? I'm like, no, actually it got harder. And she goes, well, what happened? I go, honestly, there's a Bible verse that popped into my head and it changed how I saw my present reality. And she goes, well, what was the Bible verse? And I go, well, it's this verse that says, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And I told her, I had all this anxiety because I was speaking at these events, and I was just like, man, I feel like a fraud sometimes. I feel like I'm not the right person, that there's somebody better that could be speaking at these events. And I told her as I meditated on that passage, what I extrapolated out of it was that I'm inherently valuable. Because you could almost, you know, translate that verse, but God demonstrates his own value towards us in this. While we had nothing to offer, Jesus Christ made the permanent transformation into the God-man in order to pursue us to the point of death. And as I started to believe in this idea that I'm inherently valuable, my stress and my anxiety just melted away. And it wasn't even something that I was focused on. It was just this truth that God had dropped in my lap, and it impacted my life. And you know, a few months later, I overhear her talking with her friends, and she's like, man, I was so stressed out at work, and Josh told me this thing, and my anxiety just melted away. Hmm. And I think for me, what I realized was that, you know, why am I looking for my, you know, my anxiety comes from wanting to people please and kind of this fear of man, because I look for my value in those things. And that's the lie, that my value comes from my performance. But as I started to believe in my own inherent value, I was freed up really to be who I was created to be, and live out of that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I have been caring for my mom for over 2 years, and just 2 weeks ago now, she went to be with the Lord, and it just reminded me how so often I would be in conversations with friends, whether Christians or non-Christians, and they would just say, you know, oh, Lisa, it's just so amazing that you're caring for your mom, that you're doing all this. And I have the chance to say, you know what it is? It's super hard. It is super hard, but it's something that God has asked me to do. And I'm able to share that because they're already saying, how do you do this? They're, you know, it's the implied question is, how in the world do you do this and not just be about yourself? Or how do you manage your life and do this? And so I got to include God in all of that. And then as she went to heaven to tell the story around that and all the ways that God was faithful over the 2+ years that I had her with me has been really cool. All right, I got to turn it around here because I have one more question for you, and that is on the on the concept of community, because I love what you say and the example you gave of a neighbor you talked to who went through a divorce and looked for community, and he found it. But tell us how, all in his telling of it, you were kind of disappointed.
Yeah, and this is something that I think millennials long for at a core level is this sense of belonging. Much more so than any other generation. And I think part of that is not, you know, we know about the social media thing and just kind of just not being able to quite feel like you fit in. And my neighbor, I'd been having conversations with my neighbor for years, shared the gospel with him, shared my testimony with him. My neighbor happened to be going through a divorce, and in the midst of that, like, you know, I was talking to him and kind of sharing different things with him. And I kept saying, man, I need to have you over for dinner. Like we should grab a meal, or we should, you know, grab some coffee. But I never really followed through on that because I just found myself busy or something would always come up. And he, later on, he told me, you know, maybe a year later, he goes, you know, I was going through this divorce, and it was the hardest thing that I've ever been through. And in the midst of it, I started salsa dancing, and I found community and belonging in that salsa dancing. And he goes, you know, it could have been anything. At that point, I was open to anything. Before that, I was totally against Christianity, but I was open to anything. And he goes, it could have been anything that I found that community in, but it just happened to be salsa dancing. And he, what's funny was he wasn't even saying it in a way that was like, you should have invited me to church, or you should have grabbed that coffee with me, or, he was just sharing where he found belonging and community and how much it impacted his life. And he was just so happy that he had found this community. And so many people are going through that, and I think one of the key ways that we can be sharing our faith is to create spaces of belonging wherever we go. I think so often we're so worried about fitting in ourselves that we're looking for it, but we can't find it, and yet we have the opportunity to create spaces like that for people around us. And I think that's probably one of the most powerful ways that we can share our faith, I would say that's the foundation. You create spaces of belonging, and then you go from there into, you know, speaking into people's lives.
Yeah, and that's so great because that's something we all can do. We all run in circles in different, you know, places, whether, you know, at the gym or hobbies we're invested in or school. So I think that's a great place, something attainable for everyone and to allow us to speak out of our own lives. Well, folks, that is it. We are at the end of our conversation with Josh, but you can find him on Twitter, actually, at Josh N. Chen, and get more of his musings and, you know, maybe even shoot him a note and be like, so, Josh, how are you living out your micro story and testimony today? maybe you can give them some ideas as well. So, Josh, we really appreciate you, your work with Crew, how you are pouring into the lives of young adults, and the insights that you've gained from that. So we appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, folks, as we finish the show, we are opening up our inbox and we get to welcome marriage expert Greg Smalley back to the table. Hey, Greg.
How are you? It's good to be with you again.
Doing okay. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
All right. We have the age-old question about waiting for engagement,
ooh,
kind of that time frame.
Yeah.
Yeah, the waiting game. So our listener says, I've been with my boyfriend for over 2 years. I really want to get engaged, and I'm excited for a future with him. I really think we're in a good place to get engaged, and I feel like our relationship is in a restless season where I want to move forward, but there's nowhere else I can go. I know he wants to marry me. He even said he wants to get married this year. I know God's timing is the best. How do I stay thankful while I wait for a proposal? How do I control my attitude and thoughts while I wait?
Yeah, tough situation. I want to focus on the waiting can really get me down part.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, Lisa, the bigger issue is so often in relationships, our hope is that this other person that we're with will do something so that I feel better.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, we have been taught in our culture that it's about getting the other person to do something versus really learning how to deal with these kinds of issues and our emotions. And I'm frustrated waiting. What do I really do with that? So my encouragement to her would be to actually spend some time figuring out what is the waiting about for you? Why is that a struggle? What's going on? What's behind that? Is it that I'm feeling helpless and powerless? I can't, you know, I have a better timeline in my mind, can't get him to act. Is it about feeling controlled? Is it uncertainty, insecurity, doubt? What is actually going on for her would be such a great use of time, because once she can pinpoint for me, actually, this is making me feel super insecure. I'm not sure if he's really wanting to do this now or what does this mean? Whatever it is, if she can pinpoint it, that's then what she takes to the Lord. That's what she goes to her friend, her mentor about, a counselor perhaps, to really process, here's why this is so difficult mm-hmm. for me, before she then talks to him. So I would ultimately encourage her, go talk to your boyfriend, just say, this is hard for me and here's what's going on for me. But before she does that, she needs to get clear on what is it and spend some time really caring for that. Lisa, when we do marriage intensives, so couples who are in crisis, I'm telling you, that's the biggest deficit that we find, is that people don't know how to take care of their own stuff. Mm. These troubling emotions, you know, these things that I'm feeling, they don't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't learn that. So for her, learning actually how does she care for her own heart first and foremost will only help her to be successful. And if this is the marriage that's going to happen for her,
mm-hmm.
that'll only help her. But we've got to figure out what is that really about for her.
Mm-hmm. That's good. It reminds me of that, the Pink song where she, I can't remember if it's called Broken, Not Bent or whatever, but where both she and her boyfriend or whoever it is are having these internal conversations in their heads, and neither of them are talking to each
right.
other, but they're making all these assumptions about what the other person is thinking and feeling. And this person is probably drifting away and they don't care, and they don't, when really they just need to get on the same page and have that conversation. So, yeah, that's a good point. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week's show. We do want to hear from you. Do write to us at editor@boundless.org, and we can answer your question in the future. If you want to review this question and answer or comment on it, maybe give us some of your thoughts, just go to boundless.org and search keyword 532. That is the show number, and that will bring you right to where we are. So otherwise, we will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.